At least 6 people have been killed and dozens more injured from Russian airstrikes in the hometown of Ukraine's president.
Zelensky said the dead include a 10-year-old girl and her mother.
Це тероризм, який ніхто в світі не назве інакше.
Plus, the clock is ticking on demands for Niger's military to return the democratically elected president back to power.
The U.S. does not want Russia to come into that region. If Bazoum is kicked out of power, the military junta that takes over will open wide arms. So the U.S. geopolitically knows if there's a power vacuum, Russia will move in.
And just when we started to turn our attention away from COVID, health officials expect a late summer wave. Today is Tuesday, August 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Russian missile attacks have killed a number of civilians and wounded dozens more in a Ukrainian city with major significance to its president. Associated Press correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Ukrainian officials say Russian ballistic missiles slammed into an apartment complex and a university building in President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown, killing 6 people and wounding 75 others as the blast trapped residents beneath rubble. Zelensky said the dead include a 10-year-old girl and her mother.
Це тероризм, який ніхто в світі не назве інакше.
He said the strikes were acts of terrorism. The attacks happened a day after the Ukrainian president seemed to warn of more Ukrainian attacks inside Russia. I'm Norman Hall.
At a briefing on Monday, State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said U.S. government officials will attend a Ukraine peace summit in Saudi Arabia, but did not provide details.
We do, of course, support this summit. We have long said that it is important that Ukraine be in the driver's seat when it comes to any potential diplomatic resolution to this war. It's important that countries that have not yet heard directly from Ukraine hear from Ukraine. So we are gratified that there will be countries that are attending this summit to talk directly with Ukraine.
The Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday that Saudi Arabia would invite Western states, Ukraine, and major developing countries to the talks. The military junta that seized power in Niger detained 3 more senior politicians from the ousted government on Monday, widening arrests in defiance of international calls to restore democratic rule. Niger, one of the world's poorest countries, largely depends on external aid and financing, which has been frozen. The West African regional bloc ECOWAS over the weekend gave coup leaders 1 week to return the country to normal or face possible military intervention after Niger's democratically elected president was toppled by members of his presidential guard last week. Mariana Diallo reports there are no easy options.
Members of ECOWAS, led by Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu, gave Niger's junta leaders 1 week to release and reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum. The group says all measures, including the use of force, are on the table to restore constitutional order. Michael Shurkin is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He says he applauds ECOWAS' determination, but wonders how effective a regional military intervention will be.
Even if it is possible, it's so easy to imagine really bad things happening as a result.
ECOWAS also imposed sanctions, including the suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between Niger and other ECOWAS member states. Shurkin says sanctions in this case might not be effective, especially for a country as poor as Niger.
They were ECOWAS sanctions against Mali, which proved to be completely useless. In fact, they were counterproductive because the Malian junta was able to use the so-called international campaign against Malian sovereignty to its advantage to try to rally people behind it. And it helped a very illegitimate regime create for itself more legitimacy.
Last week, Bazoum's supporters protested in the capital, Niamey, calling for his release. On Sunday, pro-coup residents attacked the French embassy as they held their own demonstration. Dr. Edgar Githua, an international relations and diplomacy expert teaching at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, told VOA that ECOWAS, in conjunction with the the United States, France, and the European Union has a strategic imperative for restoring Bazoum to power.
For the simple reason, geopolitically speaking, the U.S. does not want Russia to come into that region. If Bazoum is kicked out of power, the military junta that takes over will open wide arms. The Wagner Group, remember, the Wagner Group is still in Chad, is still in Libya. They're around there. Trust me, they will sweep in so fast. So the U.S. geopolitically knows if there's a power vacuum, Russia will move in.
France, the United States, and other countries have troops in Niger. And while some of these countries have the ability to do some targeted intervention, Shurkin doesn't think any of these governments would have an appetite in doing so.
It looks terrible. It seems to reinforce everything that many people fear and say about the French role in the Sahel, because here's France being a neocolonial power, picking and choosing leaders and not letting Nigerian themselves sort things out. Same thing if the U.S. did it.
Niger has been a key ally of the West in the fight against militant groups such as Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in the Sahel region, which has seen a number of coups in the past few years. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
As new criminal charges were announced against him, former President Donald Trump again downplayed the indictments he faces. Separately, Hunter Biden, the son of President Joe Biden, is also dealing with legal woes that are putting the president himself under some Republican scrutiny. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the story.
During a campaign rally Saturday in Pennsylvania, former President Donald Trump, a 2024 presidential hopeful, once again dismissed the indictments he faces.
These are ridiculous indictments. They want to damage the leading candidate.
Last Thursday, federal prosecutors added three new criminal counts related to conspiracy to obstruct justice in the investigation of Trump's alleged mishandling of classified documents. Former New Jersey governor and Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie, who appeared on CNN's State of the Union, commented on new evidence that would point to Trump allegedly ordering some of his staff to delete incriminating security videos.
This was the withholding of confidential classified information from the government. After 18 months of asking Donald Trump to return it voluntarily, not only did he not return it, he lied about having it.
But Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy called the ongoing legal proceedings politicized prosecution and reiterated that if he himself were to win the presidential race in 2024, he'd pardon Trump.
I absolutely think the right answer for the country is to put the grievances of the past behind us.
Another legal case in the headlines concerns Hunter Biden. Last Thursday, President Joe Biden's son had been expected to plead guilty for failure to pay taxes as part of a plea agreement. However, the deal unraveled. The wording of the pact is now being revised per a judge's request. Former U.S. Attorney Chuck Rosenberg commented on the matter on NBC's Meet the Press show.
It's relatively easy to fix if Mr. Biden still wants to plead guilty. And by the way, Chuck, I think it's in his best interest to do so.
Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy recently floated the idea of opening an impeachment investigation of President Biden over alleged financial misconduct. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, also a Republican, shared his views on ABC.
Look, America's got amazing problems around mental health, around the opioid crisis, fighting to secure the border. I'd rather have them focus on those issues.
While promoting his economic achievements in Maine, President Biden joked Friday about the impeachment idea. He has repeatedly denied speaking with his son about the latter's overseas business dealings. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
We are following these other stories from around the world. The Taliban has announced their 2 days of talks with a U.S. delegation concluded Monday, where they emphasized the need for unfreezing Afghan funds and removing sanctions to build mutual trust. Myanmar's military-controlled government has extended the state of emergency it imposed when the army seized power from an elected government over 2 years ago, according to state-run media on Monday, forcing a further delay in elections it promised when it took over. As World Breastfeeding Week kicks off Tuesday, UN health officials say a mother's milk is best. A new report finds exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months improves survival rates for infants and has many other benefits for both the infant and mother. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. A recent incident has caused one of NASA's interstellar travelers, Voyager 2, to lose communication with its mission team and is currently unable to receive commands or transmit any data back to Earth. The space agency's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that the Voyager 2 mission team accidentally sent commands to the spacecraft on July 21st, which caused its antenna to aim its signal 2 degrees off target. To properly maintain communications with an object about 20 billion kilometers away, being 2 degrees off can be an issue. Meanwhile, mission controllers are assuring that the spacecraft should remain on its current trajectory. NASA is calling the problem a communications pause until October 15th, when it will transmit orientation commands to correct Voyager 2's antenna issue. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Officials with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are seeing signs of a late summer wave of COVID infections as new cases of the virus have started to increase in recent days. I had a chance to speak with Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease specialist with Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Thank you so much for being with us. What can you tell us about what health officials are expecting?
Recognize that in past years, there's been an increase in the summer, and then a more sizable increase in the winter. And yes, here and there, we've seen a very slight uptick in cases hospitalized with COVID. And that's happening not uniformly, but here and there. We shouldn't think it's large, but this Omicron variant is very, very contagious. People are out there traveling. They're enjoying themselves. They're getting together during the summer and providing opportunities for this virus to spread and occasionally find someone who's older, frail, who's immune compromised.
We've sort of put it in the rear view mirror to some degree. It's not top and center in the news anymore. People just sort of want to forget it ever happened after so long. I personally know two people a couple weeks ago that they said they had COVID, and I was sort of taken aback, like, what? COVID? Where's COVID? You know? So apparently it is definitely still here.
Undoubtedly. Infectious disease docs and the public health community know it's still out there, know it's still being transmitted, and we anticipate that come this fall, there'll be another increase. Of course, this fall, we also anticipate that there'll be yet a new booster that will be made available, and we'll see whether we can persuade the general population out there to come in and receive the vaccine, because as you say, most people have wanted to put COVID in the rear view mirror.
When we were going through the height of the pandemic, we were hearing, oh, now we have a new variant, and this one's even more infectious. Is that still possible for this current Omicron to continue mutating? And is there any way to know if it will mutate into something more serious, or is it just something we don't know?
Every expert has a cloudy crystal ball. They cannot predict mutations. But my fingers are crossed as I say this, knock wood. We have not had a substantial new mutation since we left Delta behind and then moved into the Omicron era. We're very happy to deal with Omicron, which, although it's very contagious, doesn't seem to be quite as aggressive in making people sick. And of course, we also have to realize that by now, the general population has had experience with COVID, been vaccinated, or both. And so our population immunity, if you look at it, we're much better protected now than we were even a year ago.
What about the rest of the world? Do you anticipate we'll see similar patterns across the world as far as an uptick in cases?
Oh, I think we will see upticks in cases. Oh, yes, it certainly is global. COVID is not as seasonal as influenza. Influenza virtually disappears during the summertime and then can explode in the winter. COVID doesn't do that. It kind of smolders along all the time.
If we see upticks and people are continuing to move around the world and travel, then obviously it's not limited to this country. It definitely has no borders.
These viruses don't respect borders. They don't need passports. They travel very, very readily from place to place. And that's why we need and have a global WHO-sponsored surveillance system that monitors these COVID viruses all around the world. Because if a new bad mutation suddenly cropped up somewhere, we would be able to identify it very, very quickly, track it, and and begin to alter our vaccines to match this new variant. So we must remain alert. Our global response to COVID, we might give it a C. We still have much to learn to make sure that we can provide the latest science and the best vaccines to people who live in the developing world. That's still something for which we as a global community have to organize ourselves better. There will be future pandemics. I hope we're in better shape then than we were in our response to COVID.
Do you know of efforts underway to work on that very issue?
A lot of that is public-private conversations. The Gates Foundation and any number of other private groups, along with the World Health Organizations, are having serious conversations about that. But we still have a long way to go. You know that for a period of time, the United States was donating many, many doses of vaccine to the developing world. And we also have to develop capacities in the developing world so that they can produce their own vaccines. And that's underway also.
Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease specialist with Vanderbilt University Medical Center. An Afghan branch of Islamic State claimed responsibility Monday for a suicide bombing on Sunday at a pro-Taliban party's election rally in Pakistan that killed at least 54 people and wounded nearly 200 in one of the region's worst attacks in recent years. Meanwhile, Afghan refugees in Pakistan say they are fearing a new crackdown after Pakistani officials blamed Afghans earlier this month for a string of attacks on security forces. From Peshawar, Pakistan, Kundai Noor Nassar has the story, narrated by Roshan Norzai.
For the past four decades, the city of Peshawar, Pakistan, has been home to hundreds of thousands of Afghans who have fled war. The refugees have established themselves in the city and have warm relations with local Pakistanis, many of whom speak the same language and share cultural and religious ties. But some Afghans are worried about their future. Earlier this month, Pakistani officials blamed Afghan nationals for a series of attacks on the country's security forces.
No. I strongly reject what Pakistani officials say. Afghans are not involved in such activities. We are very happy from the local Pakistanis. They treat us like their own brothers.
After an attack earlier this month on a military base in the southwestern province of Balochistan that killed a dozen soldiers and a civilian, the Pakistani army issued a statement saying that Afghan nationals were involved in violence in the country.
It is normal that when such a statement comes from the head of the army, it will have a negative impact on millions of Afghan refugees. And it is also signals the government institution in Pakistan on how the head of the army thinks. I think the statement was not appropriate.
The UN says that there are around 3.7 million Afghans living in Pakistan, and only 1.3 million of them are registered. You said last week there was no indication that Afghan refugees were involved in terrorist activities.
No indication that Afghan refugees in Pakistan or along that border are guilty of acts of terrorism.
Since the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021, around 600,000 more Afghans have fled to Pakistan. For Khutai Noor Nasir in Peshawar, Roshan Noorzai, VOA News.
Isleta Pueblo's detective Kathleen Lucero is fighting to stop the epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous people in the United States. But police and policymakers say a jurisdictional maze and lack of resources have contributed to thousands of cases remaining unsolved. Lucy Ha with Reuters has more.
They came to you for help, and how do I help you? And I don't care if you were doing drugs and you left your kids. Yes, that is wrong. But that's not the point right now. The point is I need to go find you and bring you back home.
Detective Kathleen Lucero knows members of her Native American community well. Her New Mexico village of Isleta Pueblo is home to more than 3,000 indigenous people. As the village's chief criminal investigator, Lucero's made missing persons her priority. She's fighting to stop her people from becoming part of an epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous women and relatives in the United States.
It breaks my heart. It gets to me. It gets to the bottom of my stomach. It's really heartbreaking to know that something is happening in their family. And how do we help them?
Factors ranging from poverty and a history of colonial oppression make Native Americans disproportionately at risk of going missing. But finding them is often not the priority among U.S. and tribal law enforcement. Police officials and policymakers told Reuters a jurisdictional maze and lack of resources have contributed to an estimated 4,200 indigenous cases remaining unresolved. The head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs acknowledged his department's lack of resources, but said it was trying to create better coordination between other agencies. Some native police, like Lucero, are taking matters into their own hands. Since 2015, Lucero has handled 8 missing people cases, with 7 people found alive and 1 still missing.
I come from a very traditional family. My family name is well known, and so I have more of that recognition because of my family name, because of my family ties to traditions, and so I use that to my advantage.
Reuters spoke to families who reported inaction by police agencies over their missing loved ones. Some say police routinely blame missing Native American women for their own disappearance due to factors such as substance abuse. Lucero agrees. She says police judging victims is one of the main reasons families don't come forward to report relatives missing.
What if it was me? What if it was me? And for me as an investigator, again, that sensibility that I'm a mother, I'm an aunt, I'm a sister, and a family member, a cousin. And just because that person on the other side is not a direct connect to me, they're still somehow connected to me, and how do I help them?
Lucy Ha with Reuters reporting. And actor Paul Reubens, best known for the character Pee-wee Herman, has died of cancer in Los Angeles, according to his publicist. Associated Press entertainment correspondent Margie Zaraletta has a look at his life.
There's a good chance you hear the song Tequila and think of Paul Reubens dancing to it in the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Pee-wee Herman had a distinctive laugh. And catchphrases.
I know you are, but what am I?
Reubens created the character while part of the Los Angeles improv group The Groundlings in the late 1970s. While Reubens did several Pee-wee films and TV shows, he also had roles in Mystery Men, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and the Smurfs movies. He dealt with cancer that he hid for 6 years. He apologized for that in a final statement and said he has enjoyed making art for people. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is an Indo-Pacific nation, and as such, we are committed to building the collective capacity of our allies, partners, and friends to sustain a region that is free and open, connected, prosperous, secure, and resilient, said Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Daniel Crittenbrink. Speaking in mid-July during a U.S. House of Representatives hearing entitled Achieving Peace Through Strength in the Indo-Pacific, Mr. Crittenbrink noted that U.S. leadership in the Indo-Pacific, which of course includes the EAP region, is critical because the Indo-Pacific fuels much of the world's economic growth and will be the epicenter of 21st century geopolitics.
We have an Indo-Pacific strategy of which China is a part and not the other way around. That said, while strategic competition with the PRC remains a global challenge, competition is most pronounced in the Indo-Pacific.
So, the United States' approach to the People's Republic of China will include a strategy consisting of investment, alignment, and competition. We are investing in the foundations of our strength at home, aligning with allies and partners on our approach abroad, and competing with the PRC to defend our interests, said Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink.
Our objective is not to change the PRC, but rather to shape the strategic environment in which it operates, building a balance of influence that is favorable to the United States, our allies and partners, and the interests and values that we share.
Nonetheless, we also remain committed to maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, said Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink.
Our One China policy, which has remained consistent, has helped to maintain cross-strait peace and stability for the past 40 years. In line with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States will continue to assist Taiwan in maintaining a sufficient self-defense capability.
U.S. security depends on our collaboration with our allies and partners to address shared challenges, to build resilience to transnational threats, said Assistant Secretary Critton Brink. The United States' role in the region must be more enduring than ever. Our allies and partners are looking to our ability to deliver resources as a sign of our commitment, building on existing efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.